Blog Talk Radio.
Behind the Blue Curtain. Saturdays at 11 a.m. Eastern. Unscripted talk on police reform and race relations. Now, welcome your host, retired officer Stan Mason.
Felony traffic stop.
Put your hands out the window.
Felony traffic stop,
1836. Put your hands out the window. Put your hands out the window.
How many occupants?
How many occupants are in the vehicle?
What's going on?
How many occupants are in your vehicle?
It's only myself. Why is your weapons drawn? What's going on?
Open the door slowly. Step out. Open the door.
I'm not getting out the vehicle. What's going on?
Get out the car. Open the door slowly and get out.
What's going on?
Get out of the car now.
Well, we don't know what it's like unless we're in that position. But in this case, like the George Floyd case, they knew what was going on. They had minute after minute after minute to correct their wrongs, and they just refused to do it. They continued to humiliate a lieutenant who was serving their country. When they not only had the responsibility, but you would assume had the training to draw back and calm down and understand they had made a terrible mistake. But it just went from bad to worse. And they had to humiliate the black man, get him on the ground, shove the lieutenant on the ground until he started weeping. It is disgusting. And I just want to know, you've been studying this for a long time. Why do we keep seeing videos like this, even a year after George Floyd's death?
It's the body camera footage so many in Chicago had been demanding for weeks. This video now released to the public for the first time today. It shows an officer in hot pursuit, which in a split second becomes a fatal encounter. Adam Toledo, shot and killed by Chicago police. He was 13 years old.
The police chief says they stopped Dante Wright because he had an expired registration on his license plate. The release footage begins minutes into the stop and shows police walking up to the car, and then Wright is seen stepping out of his vehicle. Police then try to take Wright into custody after discovering he has an outstanding warrant. The video shows Wright begins to resist as cuffs are placed on him and he gets back into the vehicle.
Call 646-716-4621. Saturdays, 11 a.m. Eastern.
All right. Good morning, everybody. Good morning. Welcome to Behind the Blue Curtain. I'm your host, Stan Mason. Facebook Live people, y'all should be catching it on right now because I got to deal with these trolls that continually jack with us. But we're going out to everybody right now. Oh, what a week. No big intro to me because I don't want to throw the curse jar up. That's why I got Joe here. Joe is that alter ego to Stan. And we got a great guest with us today. But let's go around and say good morning to everybody. What's up, Chief?
Good morning. it's been an interesting topic, so I'm ready to talk about this topic and kind of get down to some of the nuts and bolts of what we've got going on and why certain elected officials aren't doing anything about it, where are they at. So That's all I
got to
say. We'll get into it.
All right. Izzy, what's going on?
Good morning, everybody. Happy to be here. Like she said, there's not much I can add to this week other than it is stressful. It is exhausting. All these instances that keep happening keep making everybody who's trying to improve this policing system and make reform and make changes, make 10 times harder for all of us who are trying to do it. But yeah, I'm ready to get into the conversation. I agree with the chief. We got to talk about some public officials who aren't doing their jobs, some chiefs who aren't doing their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Big Joe.
Well, you know I'm ready to jump in. We just had some conversation about me and the chief. So let me just put this out there. Who is the highest law enforcement official in every state?
AG.
Bingo. When the last AG lost charges in any one state? So you talking about that state? I mean, so let me just start with that. I'll yield to our guest now.
All right, you guys. We got a special guest. Hopefully, Attorney Billy Clark will be joining us also. Then Billy's in high demand these days. But got a real special guest here today. And sometimes I'm prejudiced, and since we all pay for this, we can do that this way. If you want to call in, the number is 646-716-4621. Press 1 on your phone after you hear the show, and that tells me that you want to talk. And we'll put you on. You don't have to say your name or where you're from unless you want to. We'll identify you by your area code and the last four of your numbers. What's up, Waco, Texas? Good morning. Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, y'all know this lady. Good morning, and the ATL. At this time, we're going to go down and speak with our guest, and I'm going to let her introduce herself, because this is we go back too many years, you know. But this is Jasmine Knight in the house that's running for re-election, and on here, we let people come in. It's a sad dog that don't wag its own tail. So we let her come in, and it's important, I think, in the context of this conversation, to have a judge's input, and then to have a black judge's input, and then to have a black female judge's input. So this is going to get good today. And with that, good morning, Judge. We appreciate you joining us.
Good morning. Hi, everyone. I am Judge Sonny McKnight from here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and thank you so much, Stan, for having me on the show. I am running for re-election and excited to take part in this morning show. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, what do people do? Give the election date up there. You know, because folks got to get registered, and they're going to have to do. I mean, Atlanta, we've shown the way, not once but twice, you know. But folks have got, because Indy alluded to it in his opening remarks, that we're going to call out some officials. Some are elected, some are appointed by elected officials. But if we're not voting, we're not participating in that process.
Absolutely. It's very important for us to get out and vote on May 18th. Your vote counts. And so we're looking for you to get out and vote to make a difference and to make a change in our communities. So I am calling on you to get out and vote. I am the judge from here in Harrisburg that cares, that loves on people, and that is here to help and to make a change and to make a difference. I am asking for your vote on May 18, 2021. Magisterial District Judges, just in case if some of you don't know, we are the bridge. Again, we are the bridge to the higher courts within the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. I am one of the judges that sit on the bench that judge fairly, justly, and truly. So I am asking for your vote on May 18th so that the people in Harrisburg can continue to get what they need, what is a chance, a fair chance, a second chance sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so I'm asking for your vote again on May 18th.
Okay, Judge, let me ask this before we open it up and we all just get into talking. We don't do question, answer, and interviews. But this really came to my mind in listening to you, having you here. Joe and I talked about this. Indy, the chief, we have this discussion. This is the one part that aggravates me. I don't care how unjustified the shooting may be or how do you, this is what aggravates me. We got all these protesters mm-hmm. and all these people who become now their next bird and they've got an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get them, well, what is an all-white jury? I've sat on jury duty. I've been through the selection process.
Yeah.
If you're one of these people who continually spend more time worried about how to get out of jury duty then to fulfill that civic responsibility, don't get mad when there are no black people on the jury, because sometimes, now let's just, like I said, we're just going to be real with it. Sometimes you have to, yes, jury duty doesn't pay any money. Yes, you're going to take a hit, and depending on what case you get, you might be there for a month. But when some of us are not participating in that process, you really limit the scope. We can't say, well, the court didn't understand me as a black male in America, and the whole jury was white. Well, I don't know how many of those prospective jurors got out of jury duty, black, white, or whatever, for whatever reason. So if you can say a few words for you as a judge, when you see these juries and cases, not necessarily in your courtroom, but you see these cases where you look at this jury, but you also saw the jury selection process, and you know how many people tried to get out of it or had a reason to get out of it. Would you just say how that plays out?
Yeah, it's really bad. It's really bad when the jury is picked. You want a juror of your peers. And so many of us, and I'll go ahead and say it, most of us brown people don't want to take a day off. We feel intimidated. We really think that our voice is really not going to be heard anyway, so we don't want to take a part of it. I'm telling you now, I have a case that's getting ready to come up, and I can't go into it in depth, but I want to see somebody that looks like me on the jury. I need you out there. We need you out here. We need you to have a voice. We need for you to take part in the situation. It's necessary. It's needed. And so when it comes, when you get that letter in the mail, don't get out of it. Go downtown to the courthouse, give your information, and say that I will take part. Let them eliminate you because you're not allowed to take part. But don't just get out. Don't just get out of it. And I see a lot of us wanting to get out of it. We need you. We need you.
And nothing shows that more than the Derek Chauvin trial that's going on right now, how important juries can be. Let's go on and jump right into it. I see one caller from the 717 area code. Anytime you want to chime in, just go ahead and press 1. I'll see a question mark, and I'll get you in. But let's open it up, because this has been a hell of a month.
Yeah.
But, you know, some of the judges said, let me go back to the third election. What's interesting about the judicial election is different than the popular. With the judges, it really depends on people voting. So you could have 900 people vote for a state rep, and only 2 people vote for a judge. The judge wins with 2 votes.
Mm-hmm.
So people will have a misunderstanding and a misconception about election. And I think it's by design. The other thing is, we talk about jury selection. In the voir dire hearings, you have to, if you're not there, they can't select you anyway.
That's right.
You know, I've got to be eliminated at the voir dire level to not be there at all.
That's right.
And so if you look at Chauvin trial and look what's going to happen in these other trials, you can't complain because you're not there. You're not going to court. You're not on the road seat.
That's right. That's right.
I hear people talk about, you know, even with our guy John, I'm so proud of that guy. This guy does 24 years. He gets his election card back. He's done more in one stroke than half these people out here that we know.
Yeah.
Because he counts. And the other thing is that, believe it or not, he can get called for jury duty.
Mm-hmm.
That's a statement.
Yeah.
He's, I like to say, he's 24, 25 years.
Yeah.
A quarter of his life in jail. He took the time to go get registered to vote. When I got people out here, I can't get to vote, but they'll complain.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They will march. They will throw bricks. They'll throw things. I said this to you before, and I stand by it. When they were doing the militia up in Michigan, they had a guy go up there, 2-8 man, and asked each one of those guys, are you a registered voter? Now, I was pissed, but each one of them said, yeah, I'm a registered Republican. Each one of them, to a man. It came here and did another group. I think not even 10% of them were registered voters. So who counts in the big scheme of things? How can you complain if you're not willing to stand guard at the gate?
That's right. Yeah.
Amen. Well, let's start with, we got 3 different incidents we can choose from. Before we get started, let's grab, because the judge has already got the home team. I know that 717 area code. I know that one. That's home. We're going to go with the first one, 717 area code 1862. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Coleman Elliott, and I'm listening to my sister Judge McKnight. And I believe she would be part of solution in Harrisburg as a judge that have integrity. And unlike the other judges, she don't throw the book at the people. She work with them, and I've seen it, with the people that's being convicted. Even if they have to pay a fine or something and they can't afford it, they do installments to help them out. And she's a people person in the community. She's a mother to a whole lot of the young people in the community, not just being a judge, but before she even became a judge. And I encourage all those in her district to vote for her.
You know, bro, let me ask you this, because it's been a while since I've been home. But I look at Harrisburg, and you know, it's a capital city. We make up a significant portion of the population.
Yeah.
But I don't really see anything there for people of color. And then I really don't see, and this is not a slam on anybody there, because I don't notice every little thing that goes on in Harrisburg. But when I see somebody like the judge that's in that community doing things, and I'm all the way down here in Atlanta. And before that, I was in Waco, Texas, but I grew up there. And so it is, for me, it offers some hope that somebody up there sees it, you know?
Right.
Okay, so did you have anything else you wanted to add in before we grab this next caller? Because we appreciate you calling. You're welcome to stay on and listen, or, you know, participate.
I find one of the answers also, she's a voice, and sometimes she's a voice alone. And I find that there's a problem with it, not much cohesiveness among our people. Their cry when a cop kills a black, but I don't hear too much when a black kills a black. And so we need to be more proactive instead of reactive.
Amen, brother. Appreciate it. Let me go down and get this next one real quick. Also, 717 area code 4542. Good morning.
Okay. Good morning.
How are you?
I'm well today. How are you, sir?
I'm doing good. What you got for us?
Well, my name's Barb Veo, and I have known Judge McKnight for quite a long time. I have always known her to be consistent and caring, especially in her community. I have known her to do community work and to ask others to join her in doing it. She needs to be reelected judge because she knows about the community, she understands the community, and she unequivocally supports the people of the community. When they come before her, and I also worked for her for a while, so I know her to be consistent, to be caring, and not just to see her job as a judge, as one just to meet out sentences, but to work with the people to give them chances, second chances, sometimes third chances. I've seen her work with truancy and getting the students back in school, not just trying to sentence them or their parents, but to work with the parents so that these kids get the education that they need in order to live and work in the community and help others. So I hope that everyone will go out and vote to reelect this judge, as she is one of the most caring judges that I've ever known.
All right. Well, we definitely appreciate you calling and chiming in. I'm loving the accent. It's bad when I've been gone so long. I listen to my own people, and I'm going, they got an accent. But, you know, it's always a pleasure. I miss you guys up there in Harrisburg, and hopefully we'll get Joe and Izzy. We'll come do a show up there, because Lord knows Harrisburg needs one.
Yeah.
That would be great.
Look, if you watch this trial and you listen to what the judge said, you will begin to understand the severity and the need for particular judges to be around. I mean,
it's interesting that four of us, if we have a judge like McKnight, could we change the path of something else? I would say yes. However, there's not enough McKnight. If you read some of her rulings, I mean, I can see why they wouldn't want it, because they're going to be scared of it. That's a compliment by me, Judge.
Let's take it that way.
But I was listening, again, going back to the Shelton trial, the judge is, I mean, if we look at this from a position of power, the judge is, he runs everything. And in the last couple of days, he just said that if the prosecution mentioned one item, he's going to declare mistrial. Imagine that. Here's a guy that's up for murder, manslaughter, negligent homicide. But because the prosecutor might slip, and again I use the word might, because of, at least in my mind, the prosecution's been wearing their ass about.
Yeah.
The other part of that is, if the defense is doing their job, and I said this and I maintain it to this day, the defense is doing their job because their job is to show doubt.
Mm-hmm.
He's not trying to stop this guy from getting a murder charge. He's trying to stop, he's trying to stop from getting murdered. And the win for him is a negligent homicide. At least that's the way I read it. Is the judge favoring him? I would have to say that he said a couple of things that's disturbing to me, but he's never sanctioned the defense or anything, but he sanctioned the prosecution twice.
But,
I don't know if you want
to say that. Oh, yeah, because the defense ain't really have much to say, but I agree with you, Joe, because they get tore up. Another caller, 717 area code 5499. Good morning. Going once. Going twice. Okay, we'll leave you there. You'll catch up. All right, let's get into it. Izzy?
I mean, just going back to what we were talking about, I mean, with the judge running for re-election and the judge in the Chauvin trial and leadership in general, one thing that I think we need to kind of acknowledge when we talk about voters and the people that complain that they'll vote is that apathy is bred in this environment of lack of diversity in candidates. I mean, you get worn down by constantly being thrown into the voting pool by voting for people who all look the same, talk the same, have the same priorities. I mean, up here, I'm an ad running right now for Chuck Schumer, who's running again. And I have to laugh because it's just one old white man running again. And who's backing him? Biden pops up, another old white man. And I'm like, this right here is why people become apathetic. It's why people don't go out and vote, because they're constantly presented with the same candidacy over and over and over again. And that wears you down. And I just like Google some little fractions. I mean, when we talk about just in terms of judgeships, across all Article III U.S. District Courts and U.S. Courts of Appeals, people of color make up only 20% of all sitting judges and 27% of active judges. African Americans comprise 10% of sitting, 13% of active. Hispanics are only 7% and 9%. Asian Americans are 2.5 and 4. So when you're just inundated with a sea of old white people, constantly, of the same, of they all look the same, they all talk the same, they all act the same, that breeds that apathy and that breeds that belief that it doesn't matter if you vote or not, because this is what you're voting for. What are the choices?
Well, not only that, but the voting, if you're not voting, it allows states to come up with awesome laws like being able to stop for air fresheners on your ear. I mean, if you're not part of that process, well, who put those in place? Who can get rid of them? I mean, if the people are not paying attention to the laws and contacting their senators and their legislators in their state to get those types of changes taken care of, we're never going to get it fixed. I mean, I can try to do my part, but I don't make the law, you know? I mean, but people got to get off their rear end and get in these jury pools and get out there and get voting. That's just what the bottom. How many times have we said that on this show? We should change it to the blue behind the blue curtain, go get out and vote. We should have that little tagline on the bottom.
Yeah. And we're not going to say Republican or Democrat. Make your own decisions, but participate in it. Chief, you opened up something real quick, and Joe, I'll throw this out, and then I'll let you go. You brought up, the mirror, the air freshener. Joe, you've ridden in patrol cars how many years? I've ridden in them. Chief, you've ridden in them day, night, rain. When you're out there, how often have you really been concerned with what is hanging from somebody's rearview mirror? I'll be honest. Sometimes I stop cars and I didn't even know they didn't have a rearview mirror until I got up there to do what I was going to do.
Well, you want to go, Joe, or you want me to go? You first, my brother. You first. It never happened. I'll be honest with you, it never happened. Now, I know I've gone to the drug interdiction schools and, mm-hmm. and Epic and all that kind of stuff, and they talk about some of the significance of air fresheners, not necessarily hanging from the rearview mirror, but, you know, if you had 50 of them thrown across the back seat.
Yeah.
Under the back seat. But that would be the only issue. One of the things I do want to bring up, and again, I haven't had time to research it, but that law, that particular law, to find out if that is actually true, because I've heard through the media conflicting, it was registration violation or was because of the air freshener, so I can't say whether that's a legit rule or not. Maybe somebody does know. But if it is legit, if it is 100% correct, I went, and when I heard that, I was actually out under the awning of the police department looking at the interior of my squad car, or one of our squad cars. Do you know how much junk we have hanging from
the
windshield of our squad car?
Thank you.
And so I mean, not only do we have a video camera, an in-car camera, there's an antenna for a radar system. There's the radar unit itself sitting on the dash. You want to start talking about a destructive view. We should be pulling each other over because it doesn't make any sense, you know. So if that's the reason for obstructed view, it's a pretty weak one. I heard that the law was enacted to get people to take their handicap placards out of their off their rearview mirrors. Is that really such a problem? I mean, where's the data that creates the necessity for that law? Do we have all people running into folks or handicapped individuals crashing into one another because the placard is hanging down? I mean, is there a real reason behind that? I don't think that there is, but
all of us, unfortunately, we have a defense attorney and a judge, so I can tell them, and I'm sure they're about to chew my ass up. But the reality is, that's all called probable cause. Let's call this shit what it is.
Yeah.
It's called probable cause to get into the car to do what
it's But it's not legitimate probable cause. I mean, a reasonable person would believe that a crime is being committed.
Chief, can I put it in very basic police language? That was a chicken shit stop. It was chicken shit.
It's a better leg stop. That's exactly right.
And I'm sorry if it offends anybody, but that's the cop language of it. And we all know. We've all seen those officers who do that. They want to be the big interdiction hero. So it's not about enforcing traffic safety laws in the community. They want the big drug bust.
Well, hold on. When pre-traffic stops are a really big problem, it's quota-oriented, it's financially oriented, and it's rooted in a practice that was created in the 70s that's based on racial profiling.
Yep.
And it's the whole kiss a bunch of princes because they can find a frog. That you think you're gonna pull somebody over and find drugs. That's where it's rooted.
Well, yeah, and not only that, but again, the frog analogy is pretty good, but you're right, you know, the out of X amount of styles, will you get something? Probably. Will you get a gun? Will you get narcotics? Probably. So that's why it's important that we have them, like, we have Billy Clark, because they understand that that's bullshit.
But Joe, would you disagree
with your test on this stand? Can you give your testimony when you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, mm-hmm. and nothing but the truth?
And Joe,
if you can, will you be held for perjury?
Would you disagree with this statement I'm about to say? I have sat in roll calls where the officers who were given the attaboys and the glory, they pulled this many people over last month. They wrote this many tickets. Now, here's the dangerous word. They're going to tell you we don't have quotas, but we have these things, performance evaluations, new name. And what they do is that officer, that little rookie, usually it's your 1 to 5 year officer who wants to make a name for themselves or whatever it is, and that's fine. We've all been through that portion of our life. But they're writing all these tickets. While they're writing all these tickets and they're in jail for the dog walking ticket or whatever the warrant is, somebody's business is getting broken into, somebody's car is getting broken into. So the officers who were doing proactive policing, and I'm talking primarily on midnights because that's where I was, that are doing proactive policing, whose businesses are not getting broken into, people are waking up in their car that's not broken into, those officers don't get any credit. So if Billy wakes up and he goes down to his law firm and a $4,000 plate glass window is broken and computers are missing, he doesn't care how many tickets I wrote that night. You know, Billy, Attorney Clark, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. I've got a few computer issues, but I apologize for my tardiness.
Oh, that's all right, brother. We getting into it.
I just want to chime in real quick. I kind of got the grasp of kind of what we're talking about here, as far as stopping individuals for basically minor, I guess, violations of whatever orders it may be, whether it's an air freshener in your windshield or a handicap tag or you name it.
Yeah.
I think what's happening is, you know, I'm not an officer, but I can imagine that there's certain areas where maybe there's a lot of drug activity, a known drug route. That's the rationale for using these pretext stops to further investigate for anything suspicious, anything like that. The problem we have with that is that there's, you know, for every person that you stop that may have something, you have nine people that didn't do anything, that are absolutely anything other than, you know, handicapped placard or whatever. So now you run the risk of those 90%, whatever the number may be, come into contact with a cop who's probably already in fear of getting pulled over and now they didn't do anything. So naturally they're going to be nervous, they're going to be agitated. You can't easily teach somebody how not to be afraid of the police when they're seeing every single day that people are getting killed, for showing their concealed handgun license or, you know, putting their hands out in military uniform with a U.S. flag on their shoulder, but you're still treated as though you're suspect. So that's the problem we have with all these pretext stops. And the only way it's going to change, I know, yeah, the law says this, you know, it can be dangerous if you have certain things in your view, but you got to be smart about it. And when you pull people over, does it make sense? Is an air freshener really going to cause that much problem? Probably not. Now, if they had a huge something in the middle of their windshield, then, yeah, that can be a safety issue. Then that can stop. I'm sure that would be an easy fix or easy stop. But just stopping people for random stuff, hoping that things are going to turn in your favor as far as a bigger bust or a bust in general, it's just not the smart thing to do. And the only way to stop that is we have to pass legislation to make that not a crime, make certain things, air fresheners, whatever, not a crime. So,
see, I agree and I disagree. I think there's two ways to fight. We can see that the legislatures in themselves are not doing what should be done. However, when it comes to defense attorneys and judges, who makes law? How do we get Miranda? How do we get, you know, these other laws? How do we get to the Terry stop? It happened because of you guys. Did it happen with our help? Happenstance certain, but the fact of the matter remains that most of the laws get changed because of the judiciary and what defense attorneys do. So, you know, that's why I'm excited to have you two here, because both of you are running, and I think you both need to be elected. And Dr. McPherson's case, she needs to be reelected, and we need to get you elected. But the other part of this, the other flip side is that the other four of us on this program, Isidoro, Jim, and Dan and myself, we represent that side that tells you there's a problem. The problem is that nothing. We can tell you, but it's you guys that have to take the ball and run. Certainly we can elect people, but until you are start putting the hammer down, don't mean shit.
You know, Joe, but can I inject this then? And then, Judge, I'll go to you. You know, the constant excuse that we hear, though, that comes up is training, the T word. The chiefs come out across the board. We need more training. We need more training. Yes, training is important. I think training is relevant, but training is not the magic bullet to what this problem is. Because if you take 100 officers from the same department, let's say 20 are black, 20 are white, 20 are female, and the other 40 are just white males or white females. You send them all to the same training. They all sit in the same classroom. They all hear the same message. They all take the same test. They all go back to the same department. Most of them probably on the same shift. Then we see these incidents that are going on across America, and you don't see per capita the black officers shooting people in fear of their life all the time. You don't even see the females, white or otherwise, other than Betty Jo Shelby up there in Dallas and this lady just recently, to the level of the white male officers, you don't see those shootings happening. So I don't think the problem is always training. I think the problem is the lack and unfair application of the training given. Is that always racist? No, I think a lot of it is rooted in fear. And officers are conditioned and taught to be afraid. React to this, react to that. And that's why we're seeing some of these knee-jerk reactions, and some of it I think is based upon fear. They have an inherent fear some of them bring to the job. Some of them, the fear is wrapped up in their racism. And then some of them are actually trained to develop that fear of the unknown instead of figuring out the unknown and working your way through.
Yeah, I got to agree with you completely, man. Training is a huge deal. And, you know, having been in the military for 22 years, the difference between military and their interaction with, I'll just say, enemies, is that we continually train all the time. So we're not out like police doing investigations, doing, you know, other things they have to do, community things, those kind of things. Our job is to train completely when we're not engaged in combat, basically. So, yes, there's rules as far as law of armed conflict, use of force, things like that you're tested on, scenario-based training. And then you know you're going to get it. You get in big trouble because there's a body that could get you if you do something grossly wrong. You can be held on a war crime. You can be held on international crime. You can be held against the Uniform Code of Military Justice, UCMJ. So there's all kinds of things to prevent those unnecessary uses of force or doing something that's not proportional to what's been inflicted upon them. So There's ways to fix it, but it is going to require a change to the system. And I often say the only way to change a system is to change the system. So if we continually operate as though, you know, we're going to get mad, we're going to march, we're going to talk about this and this, and, you know, I saw CNN putting together last night all these different shootings that happened over the last few months. But what are we doing with this other than adding to the blog? We have not made any change. We have not engaged our community and let them talk to the officers. You know, that's why I'm talking in Dallas County. I'm on May 13th, I'm putting together a town hall. I invited every single police chief in Dallas County and constables, sheriff, as well as the VA. And we're not getting the feedback that I wanted. We still got a few more weeks to go, but this is exactly what we need to do. We want to be, you know, we want our county, our cities of Dallas to be like Hewitt. I saw Hewitt one of the safest cities in best cities. We want that up here in North Dallas as well, North Texas as well. We want to be the same way. But the only way we're going to do it is that we have leadership that's willing to have that thick skin, you know, and let the citizens tell them, hey, this is what's going on. This is what I fear for my children when they leave my house. I'm afraid that I'm going to be, instead of planning a prom, I'm going to be planning a funeral. And that's a reality. Because, you know, officers, they shoot pretty well. If they shoot you, not time to see you're going to die. It's not off of the flesh wound. They're killing you. Because that's what they're trying to do. So we just need to figure out how to get that dialogue over the community.
I just want to jump in real quick because I believe the training aspect is huge. And after this last week, we've implemented some things in our own agency because you just can't sit around and watch this more reality-based training. And not every agency we shoot, but it's going to test everything in the use of force system that we've got. It's all of our instructors and subject matter experts will be the ones that will be the designing and implementing and critiquing the training called videotape and help. So we're going to watch people's performance and we're going to correct it. But beyond the training, I think there's a lot of stuff where on the chief side, on the police side, we start talking about officer resiliency, which is both physical and mental, and fatigue. You know, I can't talk enough about fatigue in some of these systems. And, you know, you start putting people overnight, they're going to be wiped out working those 12-hour shifts. And it's a legitimate concern that we as administrators have to look at. That's a piece of this puzzle. I'm not saying that's the issue, but it's a piece. Not only that, but the funding, the training. You know, that stuff's not cheap. I will tell you that the training that we will put on will fit within our prescribed budget, but a lot of it's going to be free because it's just going to be my time on Saturdays where I'm out there with, and some of them are going to be doing some overtime, some of my instructors, but it'll fit within the budget. But when you have an agency of, several thousand, some of that becomes a little more difficult to train. And I'm talking about all aspects of training. I'm not just talking about, we're going to take the technicians out, we're going to shoot stuff. I'm talking about de-escalation, crisis intervention training, all the scenarios will have every bit of that in it. And so the performance of the entire agency will be scaled and graded, and when we find problems, we're going to fix, and we're going to push them back in. And, again, it can't be the fearful training. And what Stan is saying is correct. A lot of the stuff that I've seen, it's all about, they're coming after you. If you've done this job, 99% of the time, nobody's coming after us. It's a citizen contact that results in you giving information to a person and you leave, and that's pretty much it. So, yes, we have to be prepared for the worst. We've seen it in Texas this week, a traffic stop officer up in Burleson gets shot immediately as he approaches the vehicle. And that's a bad guy. That guy killed another woman and stole her vehicle, and it was a bad situation. And you have to be prepared for that. I go back to that guardian mentality, not the warrior mentality. You still have to have it, the guardian mentality that we're here to serve the community and provide for the community, regardless of what it is. So that's the way that needs to be. But I agree with Billy. The system has to change. We've got to take a step back and look at how we're going to put this together. The administrators, the elected officials, the judges, the whole group of people. This can't be just done in a vacuum. Everybody's got to have a voice to say how this is going to work.
Absolutely.
Judge?
I agree with what everyone said. It's definitely true. I remember back in the day when we were coming up, Dan, the officers would come to the community. They would talk to us, shake our hands, have conversation with us, so we knew each other. They engaged with us as little kids. We weren't scared of officers when we were coming up. Now, we're scared. You don't know what's going to happen from one day to the next day. And so for me, if the officer is coming out and you're already fearful, why are you an officer? Because you're here to really aid, bay, and to protect the community. But if you're coming out and you're just doing whatever you want to do, because you can train people all day long.
Mm-hmm.
You can train them, this is what you're supposed to do, what you're not supposed to do, get out there, protect, and do the right thing. You can train them, but the officer is the officer.
You're exactly right, Judge. You can train them all you want, but if they're not good people to start with, it's not going to make a difference.
It's not going to make a difference.
What's the difference?
And we all have to come together. I mean, my job is not to be against the officer. My job is not supposed to be against the legislators. We're all in it together to make our communities better communities. And so we sit down and we talk. Every time I have met the chief officer to get things they're going for 10. If your 10 is too dark, Chief Carter, your 10 is too dark. You can't see it. Who's your friend this will? You're coming after the community, and the 10, I can see the people.
law officers will not like me on this one, but that's an inspection. That's a vehicle inspection issue. It's not, you know, you mean you can't get your vehicle registered because you have the wrong tint on your vehicle. I mean, yeah, it's a violation of the law, but it's not in our wheelhouse as officers, in my opinion. Is that the place where you get your car inspected?
Well, we might as well start checking tire pressures too. Let me grab a caller real quick that's been holding for a while, and then Izzy, we're gonna go to you real quick. 717 area code 5499. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, we got you now. What's up?
Oh, hey, good morning, man. You guys are so rich. I have enjoyed you all over this past year or two, I think year and a half, but Stan and Mr. Devlin, Mr. Mosley, Mr. Rodriguez, you guys are so rich. And I'm telling you, this is golden. So a couple of things, because my mind goes all over the place. I've worked for more than just Judge McKnight. So I have worked for her before, but I've worked for other judges before her. So I have a great comparison. I was married to a cop before, so I have some comparison there. I have a whole lot to say, but I want to say first that this training thing has really been pissing me off quite a bit, because I see, especially in this second to last incident with the officer Potter, who was a trainer, right? And she had 26 years of service, and yet her mind could not be trained. So when we talk about training, if we cannot train the mind, because most of the time the mind is what is hidden. You can be cops, you can be peers, you can be all of that, but you have that one cop that never lets you know what's really going on in their mind, and that is where the problem comes. That's where the taser, that's where the hands up and still the other officer could shoot a 13-year-old kid, because what's going on in their mind is what cannot be trained. That is what has to be changed, but that change has to come within that person. That's one. Two, the other thing I want to say quick, cut me off, Stan, when you have to. This culture of fear that we live in is because we always see the other person in front of us as the other. We never see them as ourselves. So that fear culture comes from not seeing that person, not seeing that citizen as yourself. You see them as someone that's a target, someone that's different, someone that you have to fear. So that's a whole nother thing that comes into training. How do we see that person as we see ourselves? Because then we have to deal with motivations. We have to deal with a whole lot of other things. Stan, you started off this morning talking about where is Jesus, because one of the guys laughed. And I cracked up laughing because this week I had the same thought, but Pat Robertson showed up. Wow, Pat Robertson shows up, right? And he talks about the cops. It isn't that the cops are bad, but this thing about blacks and brown people, it has to stop. And he talked about the skill set, that he needed smarter, that we needed smarter thinking cops. And, of course, I disagree, because it isn't about the intellect. It is also then about the cultural mindset and what is in that mind. We're all living, you police officers, regular citizens, we're all living in active PTSD. We all are living in an active war zone, and we all are experiencing the same thing. But what is in the mind of any soldier will tell you how that soldier will fight on the battlefield. Thank you.
All right. We appreciate you. Wow. That's why I love this show. Because, like I said, when you call up here, we're going to let you go. As long as you're making sense and you're rational, because we love learning too. So we're definitely going to listen, because she did exactly what this show is about, letting everyday people talk for a change instead of the figurehead. Izzy, I know you've been biting at the bit, brother. Come on.
I mean, yeah, just a couple points I want to throw in there. I mean, when we're talking about the Dante Wright situation, I mean, that's getting back to these traffic stops. And there's a simple solution to this. And I always bring up the example of Fayetteville, North Carolina. They stopped their officers from doing stops like that work related specifically to safety. So we're talking, they only pulled you over if it was, you were on red light, stop signs. That's it. Before they do that, and this is rooted in the practice is rooted in is unproven results. So there were, in the study that happened in FISO, there were 20 million stops in a year. Out of that, the number that resulted in actually arrests or anything were 2%. 2% out of 20 million. And of those 20 million, 1.5 to 2 times more likely to get pulled over. So what happened after FISO changed this and stopped their officers from doing these, all these stops? Racial profiling went down by 50%. Traffic safety increased and traffic death decreased across the board. And they're trying to spread that out to North Carolina. These are the types of changes when we talk about evolution, the evolution of people. These are the types of changes we need to do. We have to pull cops out doing these types of stuff, and it's because it'll prevent people from losing their lives and it'll prevent violent situations from happening. And then when we talk about the type of, like the judge said, with officers who walk through the streets and create empathy and talk, we need to start looking with greater scrutiny at hiring and recruiting practices in your department. Because I talk to dozens of departments around the country, they all talk about it. It's a funnel system. Like they're not asking the questions. They're not looking for empathetic officers. They're asking some basic things, and they're relying on the system of the hiring process, the recruitment process, the police academy to filter out any possible bad guys that might be in there. And as we can see, it doesn't work. So the hiring process needs to change. You need to start asking these officers not, you know, certain questions. You need to start asking, like, empathetic questions. You need to start going into the social media industry. You need to start asking them, how involved are they in the community? What do you do? Do you volunteer? Are you from this community? And if you're not, how involved are you in your community that you're from?
That's
you need
right.
to start looking for empathetic people. And then on top of that, we're going to look at recruitment. We still have police departments that send out recruitment videos and start recruitment practices that they sell policing as an action-oriented, super fast, go, 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 exciting industry. And what are you going to get if you keep selling that message, that image? What type of people are going to be attracted to that? You know, when you're making videos for recruitment that look like an action movie, who goes to see action movies? Who's attracted to that type of experience? You're not going to get the type of officers that you need. You're going to get action junkies. You're going to get people who operate on hair triggers. So we've got to start rethinking this, because that's how you're going to get these empathetic police officers, by hiring them and finding them and recruiting the appropriate way. But if we're still selling it, like it's a Michael Bay movie, you're not going to get these type of people that want.
But let me show my age real quick. I remember seeing a recruitment poster that had T.J. Hooker on it.
But you know what I see, Izzy, and what you said, I agree. But I think one of the fundamental problems that I see in what you're saying, I agree 1,000%, that's the way to go, is the fact that policing and the criminal justice system has become modern-day slave farms. It generates revenue. It produces revenue. It's transcended into private businesses, for-profit prisons. You've got judges who have stock in these companies. You have cities who want to do whatever they want to do based upon what? Income revenue. If we go back and look at the Ferguson DOJ report, that a lot of people think it centered all about Michael Brown. No, it didn't. Michael Brown actually played a small part of that. A lot of it talked about these traffic stops that were going on in Ferguson and then the city next to it and then the city next to it. But, of course, people would have to read it and go further than Fox and MSNBC to actually know what's going on. So sometimes today, asking people to read is like, you know, pulling teeth. You know.
Yeah, so I mean, like that base that you talked about in Ferguson, because we even talked about here in Texas, the Texas police chiefs, and made a point of it. You know, I mean, they had some 20,000 citations or stops in a community of only 19,000 people. I mean, they had more tickets than people living there. And there were things like pedestrian in the roadway, mm-hmm. sidewalk provided. And, you know, so you know, the real reality of that is a real safety issue, or is that a reason to screw with somebody?
Right, but I think she...
And they proved, the DOJ proved it was domestic.
Right, but I think across America right now it is, because when I look at these stops, whether it was the Lieutenant Azario or whether it was Dante Wright, they're both chicken shit stops, first off. That's Stan's opinion. Folks can get mad. That's the first thing. The second thing is we're in the middle of a pandemic when people couldn't walk into the DPS and get the driver's license renewed to do it online. Some of these people may or may not have broadband where they are. They may or may not be able to do it. And I think that at some point, Some of these departments should have said, if you stop them, give them a break. Have them park the car and get a ride. Do something else other than escalate the situation.
So are you about to make the point for this thing called common sense?
Yeah, but yo, what I'm gonna go to is that these stops that are just minor, it's bullshit stops. But what happens? Who escalates it? It's not that citizen. And when people say, and I'm gonna say this and I'm gonna be quiet, I'm sick of hearing just comply. Philando Castillo complied, and he ain't here. So when you're black, it's easy when you're not to say, just comply. When you're black or you're brown in America today, and you're pulled over, and I don't care if the officer's black or white coming up to my car, Stan ain't comfortable, okay? So I don't know what's going to happen with me. I don't get to say, well, I'm just going to have to pay this $300 ticket and buy this, and we'll take a hit. I'm wondering if I'm going to live, depending on how that officer feels. And being 6'4", I'm not the biggest, heaviest guy in the world, but if he feels like I'm a threat or she feels like I'm a threat, I can be dead. That is a fact. And with that, I'm going to sit back.
Well, I was going to say very quick, you know, here in Texas, when the pandemic hit, under the governor's executive orders, specifically what you talked about, DPS being closed and registrations, you had a pass. You had a pass until, I think, Monday. That your vehicle can be unregistered. I don't know if they had it in Minnesota. I have no idea. But that was not probable cause during the pandemic under that executive order for the traffic stop. And so because if the government is saying, give me a pass and registration, you can't really stop them for it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just not a violation of law under an executive order from the governor. So I don't know if Minnesota had that. That particular issue. I mean, it's the stop itself is shaking. And before anybody gets in, I'm going to ask this question to the panel, but before anybody writes and says, you know, resisting arrest is not a reason to die, I agree. The amount of resistance that young man showed versus the force that was used was completely disproportional and resulted in an excessive use of force. But on the other side, outside of that traffic stop, and since Billy's here and the judge is here, if the traffic stop is a legitimate stop, real probable cause, and an individual is wanted, what are y'all thoughts about the resistance, the resistance that's offered? I mean, if you're under arrest, you're told you're under arrest. I know if I ask Joe, if you tell somebody they're under arrest, where are they?
Under arrest.
Yeah.
Right. So I mean, you know. And I think it's something that we need to talk about, and whether you believe it or you like it or you don't, you know, resisting an official arrest. I'm not talking about these other people we're talking about nationally, but on a real legitimate traffic stop with a wanted person, you know, because you prosecute those cases, Billy, you defend those cases. I mean, so you know, we need to have that conversation about this idea that you just have the ability to resist. I get all the other things talking about, but I want everybody to know that just, you know, you can't just start firing the police.
Yeah, I agree. And say you can't, you know, if someone stops, they should not put their lives in jeopardy by doing something crazy, like going for something and run and dash away. That's one thing. But at the same time, the officer is the one that should be the professional and that should know to be able to assess the situation. Okay, right. Yeah, this person is running away. I mean, we can catch them another day. What we're not going to do, and what we shouldn't do, is pull out our weapon. Because now we're instituting deadly force in the equation to someone that maybe didn't have a weapon at all, or, you know, they had a cell phone, because a cell phone sometimes can look like a weapon. So let's not introduce a weapon into the variable unless the need, you know, it calls for that. You know, somebody's pulling something out, there's a gun, they're going to shoot. That's a different story.
But Billy, the chief posted a video coming in, and chief, that was a very important video, and it's a shame this officer lost his life, and it's a tragedy. But it's the one where the trooper walks up to the car, got the guy pulled over. Now, it's daytime. He knew the guy had a gun. He talked about the gun. He never pulls his out. His hand's not on it. He's, why don't you come back to my car and talk to me? He even walked away from being able to view that weapon, while the guy was getting out the other side of the vehicle. And when they came into where he could finally see the guy on the other side of the vehicle, the last words were, oh, shit. And you know, when I look at that, and that is a tragedy. But he gave this guy so much rope, so much trust. It's daytime. I don't know if race came into it, so I'm not going to introduce that. But for whatever reason, he felt comfortable with that person with an AR-15 in the car.
Yeah. I don't know what the policies are in the training for that, but it seems like to me, just thinking about it, being approaching that vehicle on the passenger side gave that person a little bit more room to get a weapon, target, maybe hide. I don't know what the policies are for police officers, but it seems like if that officer would have approached him on his side, he could have more more eyes on him and been able to direct him.
I don't know. Yeah, I was going to say, what we're now learning is passenger side approaches are actually safer than driver side approaches because you have a larger mitigation zone as far as escape. I'm going to say that if somebody's been in the passenger, the driver's seat with an AR-15, you know, that's still going to be a little more difficult turnaround to take shots at the officer, but... and state pride, we gave a bunch of latitude. We gave too much latitude in that incident, and we have incidents of this last week where we have no latitude. You know, and I'll tell you right up front, you know, before the defense and the prosecution ever get into the shooting at Brooklyn College, that young man displayed what we term defensive resistance. He's trying to get away. There's no active aggression. You know, so there's a certain level of force that must be proportional. You got the new attorney and judge, you know, it has to be proportional in order to take that individual into custody. It cannot be anything more than what is required to bring that person into custody. And if we want to do a show on the tactics or the lack of tactics in that arrest, we can spend another 2 days on just left one incident because it is, it's poor. I don't want to fill the curse card, but it's a poor arrest. Not only does it result in the tragic loss of life, but if those officers had physically done what they needed to do to arrest that young man, if those warrants were legit, he would be alive today. They're not even doing what they're supposed to be doing and putting handcuffs on. I mean, we're about to apply handcuffs and then we pull the handcuffs away. Then if we got one cuff on him, he'd be in custody and he would be alive.
One thing that you just said about the cuff, you got to realize what this guy's probably thinking right in Minnesota.
Oh, no, yeah.
Was handcuffed, and they still died.
I don't disagree, but I think if they had gotten cuffed, taken and held them, put them in a car. Well, I mean, I think if they would have done it the correct way. Now, I'm not talking George Floyd. That incident right there is an absolute train wreck and a mess. But it's incumbent on the officers, if we do affect that arrest, and then they de-escalate that situation.
But
that's what we have.
Right, but Chief.
And you guys know, Judge and Billy, I know you know, because this is something that we talk about quite a bit. A lot of times people resist simply because they don't understand why they're being arrested.
Right, but if we go back. But Chief, if we.
I believe it should always be a conversation. Engage the person.
Yes.
It's just on how you handle it right from the.
Yes.
You're going to get a reaction to whatever you do. So it's how you started and how it's going to be ended. And so
yes,
if you approach the individual in the right manner, the individual 9 times out of 10 is going to give you that same respect. So it's how you engage the individual. Because I don't care what type of traffic stop it is or how, you know, whatever's happened on that day, whatever you have to pull the person over, or I think that if it's done in the right manner, it will always end good. But if
it's
not wrong, it's going to end bad. So if you're pulling me over, have a conversation with me. If you have to take me out to the booking center, let me know exactly what you're doing. You know?
Yeah, you're 100% correct. It will
never end in anyone's life being taken. Never.
That's exactly right.
But Chief, I know, I'm just real quick, because I got to add this element in, because I've been holding this one. And this is my problem with the whole Dante Wright thing. whether resist or didn't resist, I agree with what you said. But I'm going all the way back to what Taser International said when the city of Waco at the time where I was employed spent all that money on the best Taser possible, developed a curriculum and course that was based on recommendations from Taser International to be, one of the things we're told is you don't tase anybody in what? A vehicle that's running, an elevated position. For her as a 26-year veteran to even consider employing the Taser in that situation, to me, was tough. Well, she made a mistake. She got confused. 26 years. You know, if you're standing on a bridge, you don't say, don't jump, I'll tase you down. You know,
I'll tell you, when the video first came out, when they asked what the press conference, and I was sitting in the office, and I thought, man, that recruit messed up. That recruit is done. That was the first initial thought. I mean, the force is wrong. Let's just get it out there. It's wrong. The whole situation is that individual has been held accountable for their actions. Right? I don't know the circumstance behind it, but when I heard that it was a 26-year veteran, I almost fell and hit the floor. I thought, how? And I mean, so I go back and my mind starts to wander. What's the training? What's the mental state of this person? I mean, the whole thing, and this is a person that's training another officer. What in the world are they doing in that agency? I mean, they're coming down on me for it, but what in the hell are y'all doing up there?
Bill, I had a question on the Taser. I think it was an X26. I don't know if your department uses that.
Yep.
But does that Taser, does it have to be charged before use, like right before use, or is it?
Yeah, you got to turn it on. I mean, there's a switch at the back of it. You got to manipulate with your thumb. So whether you're cross-draw or opposite, so I'm a little different. You know, the chief says, well, it's got to be cross-draw, so you got to go across the body. I carry my Taser on my left-hand side. I operate with my left hand, even though I'm right-handed. So if I confuse it, I'm really screwed. But you have to physically manipulate the switch to turn it on.
So there's no trick. It's just thinking, okay, if you're saying Taser, and you thought it was a gun, then you missed that step way back. You had to charge the thing.
When you turn it on,
I'm gonna say. There's no mistaking a Taser. My thought behind this is that let's look at the physiological, psychological realm of this person, just based on the video. I am not a doctor. I teach use of force, and I consider her in what we call condition black. What that means is that they don't know what the heck they're doing. Their mind is so gone that they can't even process what is happening in front of them. My personal opinion, it means that they have lost all human brain instincts, right? Cognitive thinking is gone because of that situation and that short little clip.
Okay.
So the tunnel vision, the physiological changes that have taken place, and again, for such a low level of resistance, I'll be honest with you. I've had people resist to the point where we've been shot at. That's a pretty high level of resistance.
But, Chief, based upon
somebody's trying to get back into a car.
But based upon what you just said, Chief, I understand it and I agree with it. Now, let's take all that the officers experience and their trauma and what they're going through and how they feel. Who initiated that stop? It wasn't the citizen. It was the officer. So let's take all of that passion that we have for the officer and understanding their mental condition. I'm not disagreeing with you, but I'm saying, how about we now apply that to the person who has a rational fear of police officers, not from what may happen, but from what their personal experiences, whether it's in their neighborhood, whether it's in their family, or whether it's in their city, if they can identify with Philando Castile. When Stan was in Waco, I could identify with Philando Castile. Why? Because sometime when Stan was off, Stan was driving around with his off-duty gun that the general orders told me I had to have in the car. And what would Stan have to do? Same thing, Philando. Here's my ID. Let me get it. And it didn't work out for him. So naturally, that's in my mind. I can't afford to say, well, you know, Belmead or Dallas or Fort Worth? Is it Minneapolis? We don't have that luxury.
What's going to happen is, particularly in that case, it can, remember the term, fall of war. They're going to use that term. But now going back to the X-26, X-28, we were trained that, first of all, if at the beginning of the ship, you have to check it out before you even pull it. So now you not only know that weapon is ready to fire, you have to manipulate it, you have to put it in the holster, and it has to be checked again. So now you got a redundancy that doesn't allow for that mistake if that be that. But look at it. I said this before and I maintain it. The problem is that these officers fail to recognize you must respect the people. They don't have to respect you. I don't give a shit what else is said. And that's where we start. Until they get that right, nothing changes.
I think, Joe, it's got to be a revamp of the training and the philosophy. You got to have a checklist in your mind. I don't know why, you know, the officer doesn't vocalize, hey, charger taser's on. That's their process, knowing, I'm no kidding, I'm flipping a switch, I know it's a taser now because I just said it. And the perpetrator or alleged perpetrator now understands, okay, I'm getting ready to buy taser. Because he just said taser's on, and I know he's not pulling the gun now because you have to take that action step. It's the same thing we do on airplanes. When we fly airplanes, when I fly an airplane, you have to say, gear down. And you're saying that out loud so someone else can hear you, i.e. your partner, co-pilot, gear down, hands on it, so you're not going to land the airplane with gear up.
Billy, what you just said is important because
that's what they did. However, again, the idea that this person is that aggressive, the chief said was stands that was very true. We're trained. You can't fire into the car even with a taser.
Yeah, but Joe, you gotta take a step back. You gotta peel that onion back. You can say taser all day and still be holding a Glock. You can
wait.
Physical force on folks. I'm not talking about punching in the face. I'm talking about Gracie, jiu-jitsu. I'm talking about human force science research. I'm talking about putting Joe will understand because Joe shows his hand. And I'm not talking about legitimately just coming up and punching somebody in the face. I'm talking about certified, bona fide tactics that for ground control and bringing people into custody that want to fight. I go back to what we're talking about. And that I can't tell how big he is. Had he put a waist lock on that young man and brought him down to the ground, we wouldn't have this conversation. But we may have a conversation about a bad arrest or a crappy stop because of air pressures, but he'd still be alive if they would have, you know, used the appropriate amount of force and control him. I'd like to, you know, you're a lot more old school. It was way different back in the day. We all know that it was. And I think that's part of the reason that, you know, I mean, when's the first time you got a taser?
Let's not talk about
Joe's first taser was a slingshot.
You didn't have that tool about. My dad was a cop in 68 in Deerfield Beach, Florida. He had a gun in handcuffs and a stick. That's all he had. He and his partner would clear out bars. He never shot anybody. He didn't tase anyone.
Right. We talked about this before. And I maintain that these officers are too mechanical in their responses. We've gone from hands-on, we talk about it all the time. There was a time, you know, even when we were growing up, think about this. I mean, not for you, attorney, and our great jurors and jurors, there was a time that you were boxing in that world. And the fight was over. You didn't pull guns, you didn't pull knives, it was 5B.
Yeah,
so cats are afraid to fight. I mean, is there sometimes that you should fight? Yes. Are there sometimes you need to put hands on? Yes. But because it's so mechanical, oh, let's use less than lethal. How about use your mind first? How about that?
You know, Joe,
one of the things that I used to do, on my stop, I make them laugh. I mean, I like the one lady I saw. The lady, she goes around the school bus. She said, you know, should you be out catching criminals? I go, I am on that shit.
Yeah.
You know, she tells me, hey, you know, why aren't you eating donuts? You like, ain't none in. You got some? So you take them out of the square, and again, did she feel good? I gave her tickets, but she felt good about it. I feel good about it.
Absolutely.
You know, I think. I'm sorry, Judge. The veteran officers that are there, and when I say veteran, I'm talking about 15 years or more. I'm not talking about 10 years and you're going to be city manager by the end of the month and all that. You know, we all go through a phase in policing. All of us have gone through it. I'm the hero. I'm out here writing all the tickets. I'm doing all the stuff. I came in the crack wars in the 90s in Waco, Texas, of all places, Crack Central. You know, but only reason I survived there had nothing to do with the great equipment Waco PD gave us. And we had good training. My survivability went up because, A, I lived right there at 1911 North 6th Street. I lived right in the hood. B, I went to the schools on my off time, and it worked, and ate lunch. C, all those kids in the hood saw me playing ball at the Dewey Center, at the Bledsoe Miller. I was out there some days, the drug dealers were coming, who's next up? We not dealing cop drugs in there. We in there playing ball. So they got to see me in the corner stores. They got to see me at the, they knew Stan. So at midnight when I'm pulling the car over, there may be two people in the car, I don't know, but somebody in that car would say, hey, man, that's Officer Mason. Nah, he's cool. He's different. And it wasn't because I was black. It was because they could identify with me and I could identify with them. The problem comes when that officer, whether they're black or white or male or female, who interacts or lives in these communities, speaks up on behalf of those citizens, the officer's feelings get hurt, the administration's feelings get hurt, city council people's feelings get hurt, so let's ostracize this officer.
Wow.
He or she is anti-police. They're anti-department. They're causing dissension in the community. I'm not telling you anything that you don't tell me in roll call. Because you're trolling somebody's Facebook instead of going out there on the street and meeting them. And too many officers today are doing Facebook investigations. Yeah. Instead of taking their ass out into the hood and meeting the people. And once you understand what they said, when you see the conditions they live in, then you can better understand why they
said
it.
Right. Absolutely.
I'm sorry.
1,000% stand. And Disney was touching on that too. And I was wanted to get back to that same exact point, that if you live in the community as an officer, you will better understand the people in the community. It's so many times that the officers live outside the community, come in the community, do their dirt, do what they need to do, take a paycheck and go back out to their community. But until you live in that community and understand that community, you will always do the opposite of what needs to be done in that community.
Well, I think part of that, so an issue that we have with that, I would love to have all my officers live in our community, but some of them legitimately can't afford to live in our community. That's one part of it. But besides that, and knowing that that's a hindrance for me to get them here, it's incumbent upon me to make sure they are invested in my community and me to be on top of them to be invested in my community.
Right.
That's my job. So you know, making sure that we're on the same page with our community folks and making them go out. Well, I say making them go out. Now they volunteer to go out and visit with people in the community and have these meetings and make an investment in the community. That becomes important. And as they move up, hopefully they get to move in our community. But that's, you know, I know that's a problem across the country, and I would love for that to happen too, because I think you have more than an investment if you're there. But there's simply some places support up where Izzy's at. The NYPD guys, they can't live. They're out on the island. They're somewhere else. So.
But Chief, what's amazing though, under what you're saying, I agree. But what I find amazing was during the 90s, and I'm speaking Waco area, when all of North Waco was a hellhole, East Waco was a cesspool of drugs. The city wasn't putting any money in there to help those people. The officers were out there doing the best they could. We had drug wars and drive-by shootings in Waco during that period. It was the most violent city in America per capita. Look it up. And we're out there. The city had programs where they would have officers live not in the hood and not in the suburbs. They would almost give you a house in what was called the transitional neighborhood. Now, but see, right. But here's the thing with that, though. This is what bothers me with politicians when they choose to implement solutions. See, when there was crack wars going on and we wanted to get the property value set up and get these people under control, they had no problem offering these officers houses. Now you've got everybody wants to make, I'm sorry, Waco, I got to put you under the bus. Everybody wants to make a dollar. You got these unrealistic property taxes, unrealistic property values. A handful of people are making money to hell with where people have to live. So if you really want your police department to be reflective of your city, guess what? Somebody, we're going to put this house aside for this new officer with three kids so he can afford to live in this city. The city's got to invest in officers. If you don't want to give them a pay raise, you don't want to get them mental health, you don't want to give them all these other things, give them, how about they get, as long as they live within the city limits, their water bill's free? How about that part? So the city is not without giving something. They don't get to wave a Blue Lives Matter flag and run away scot-free. That's bullshit, because they have no problem gentrifying communities. They have no problem bringing resources when investors show up and put sidewalks where kids have walked to school in high grass and weeds. The city has no problem coming up with money. Then it's only when we talk about helping the least, the impoverished, the poor, the people who suffered before this became a desired place to live. That's where cities have a problem. I agree with you 1,000%, Chief, but I also see from the other side, that's the problem. And the officers who were in there begging the city council, begging the chief, we need sidewalks. These people just want restrooms in the public park. Hello, Hood Street Park, Oscar Dukan, Jay Waco, you hear me? And they're still not there. Mm-hmm. You can go to the city park and have an event. You just don't have nowhere to go to the bathroom. You got to drive home. But yet you can go out where there's a boat ramp so people can put their bass boat in the lake and go fishing, and there's bathrooms everywhere. That's bullshit. And I'm not blaming just the city. Where are all these leaders at? These are conditions that conduce crime, that make it harder for the officer to police. It makes it harder for the citizen to live. And some of that are the environmental things that add to this conflict. And I'm sorry.
I think one thing, Stan, also, I think getting more officers in the community, you'll have to start, you know, going to Waco Hospital, mm-hmm. to University Hospital, go to Midway, develop programs just like ROTC does. But for police, so now you have students that are not only interested in the profession, but they're from that community. You're going there. You have programs in place.
Mm-hmm.
So when they graduate, now, you know, they can go to MPC, go to, you know, whatever college they need, whatever the requirements are, get that extra training, and they're already in the community. So you don't have to convince them to stay.
Right.
They
are. I'll tell you, Billy, that's happening. We actually are implementing, not just us, but with Waco PD. It's so brand new. I got an email about a TAC program from a Waco community officer wanting to know if we had, my agency had an interest in that. We're already there with our SRO program, and I gave them a big hell yeah. But that's so important, and it's proven mm-hmm. to be important to cultivate our next generation officers from the people that are already here from the community. And you're 100% correct. You couldn't be any more correct on that situation. So and in this instance here, Stan, I'll tell you what, it's about to happen. And I get to have a seat at the table on this one too. So I'm super excited to get something, that program up and running, because I believe that it's vitally important for the future law enforcement.
I'm glad it is, Chief, because for too long in Waco, Waco had a drug narcotics task force, they had a gang task force, they had a marshal task force, they had no power broker.
Well, I think part of that, you know, of course, I haven't talked to Chief Dorian much because, you know, she has been extremely busy trying to get her feet wet around here, but I'm pretty sure that's part of her
excellent.
I'm pretty sure this is a part of her thing. I want to go back and I want to talk about, and I'm just going to give props where props are due to Chief Victoria. But, you know, what we were talking about, this officers in the neighborhood and meeting with the community, you know, she has a program called Relational Policing that she brought from Houston PD. Mm-hmm. And that's what this is. Mm-hmm. And I think that you're going to see a significant change It's an awesome program. I've looked at it. I've checked it out. We've been doing relational policing in my city. We just didn't call it relational policing. We just call it police. She has a program that she puts in place that I think is going to be is going to make a significant impact. And I think it's going to be one of these things that is going to put the city of Waco on a map as a model for other agencies to look at and say, hey, how is it that they're doing that? And they're going to come in. I honestly believe that.
Amen.
I've got faith in it. I think that's going to be a really good deal. I just wish I had a name for it because then I could, you know, throw it out there. Got credit for it.
I've had people mention this to me is that those programs are all well and good and they are needed, but one of the keys to those, if you're going to have one of those programs that establishes a dialogue between departments and the communities, you need to make sure that the community side is actually fully representative of the community.
Yeah.
Yep.
In these situations, you'll get, so they're representative of the communities, and who are they? They are the 1%, the unaffected members, the richest members, the most influential members of that community that are at these community meetings. Meanwhile, the most affected by the policing methods aren't at the table. And that's one of the things that needs to be maintained. And another thing I want to bring up is going back to this Dante Wright thing and going back to training. Like the chief said with this 25, 26 year veteran, there's that song of war, like Joe said, or the what did you call it, chief? The code?
The condition. Yeah, when the condition black, when we start talking about digital violence and changes.
Right, condition black. So I don't know for sure, but my personal opinion on the Dante Wright thing, I'm going to call bullshit on condition black for her. But I don't know. I'm not a professional. That's just my opinion. And the Chicago thing, I know even less. I will say that if condition black is an actual thing, then we need to look at how these officers are being trained and what they're being trained to do. Because PERP, ICP, FBI, one of the things they've been pointing out for years is that police officers are getting too much more training consistently with drawing and firing their weapons than with anything else in police departments.
Yep.
I followed branch recruits through the NYPD's training program when they had just rolled out their new 21st century policing training practices. It's all about de-escalation, conflict resolution, all of that stuff. And they did have those programs in there. They did do this. But even though they did do them, it felt very much to me like window dressing. So the majority of the stuff that they did had to do with drawing and firing their gun. They spent more time on the range than they did doing de-escalation or anything like that. We're talking hundreds of hours versus like 8 to 20 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, the most consistent, continual training that police officers get is drawing and firing their weapons. So if that code black, if that condition black is happening, and they're going for their guns, that is a conditioning that happens in general. And we have to switch off of that.
Think about it. I use that term because it's actually something that's come out of Texas State when we start talking about active shooter. And this is where it comes from, but it happens there. It's basically your heart rate going beyond where you can critically think. And that's really what it comes down to. And it's proven time and time again where, I mean, you think about the dynamics of people when they're involved in critical incidents, and you have some people just stand there and, they freeze. That's what condition black is. This one happened just a little bit more. I'll use it as the lizard brain. It was a primal response is what she had. There's no critical thinking there. So whether it's a physiological change or there's something else there, to me it's just a suspect. But you're right. We do see significant amounts of training with pulling the weapon. I've said that for a very long time, that we don't train on this stuff and driving. Up in the big cities, it may be a little different because of the staffing levels, but, Sam can understand how much do we drive, but how much do we train on driving? I mean, there's not a whole lot. How about handcuffing? How many times do we handcuff somebody, but how much do we train on handcuffing individuals? De-escalation, common sense, verbal judo.
Report writing. Report writing. How about that part? Documenting facts.
Minimal compared, and I can guarantee you that if we can fix our report writing, it may make Billy Clark's job a little more difficult if we can make it right. I know he can find flaws in the paperwork, but you're 100% correct. We train on that, and we need to get we're required Texas by law to qualify once a year. once a year. That's the requirement. So if we're doing that 17 times a year, we're missing the mark. And so we need to set up scenario-based training to deal with de-escalation and everything else that encompasses these encounters. And we use real-world examples, as like what we've had this week, and make those scenarios happen, because those are legitimate scenarios. And how do we act? How do our officers react on those types of stuff?
That's
my reality-based
training. The train is very important. I think we hit that. I think everybody talks about training. But I think the key that we can't miss is that we need that communication with police officers and the citizens. We need those town halls. We need those. That's why they have school board meetings with the parents and everybody gets to confront the board about what's going on in the education and needs of their children. We need the same thing, because we're almost at a, I don't want to say an epidemic to these kind of shootings, but the community, they're terrified. Every single day when I leave, and I've said this before, when I get in my car, that's the most terrifying thing that I have for that day. It's just driving.
It's sad.
And I'm thinking about, every barrel. When I make that right-hand turn, am I turning into the closest lane instead of the normal lane that people, that normally travel to that lane?
Right.
That's probable cause stop. I'm thinking, what am I doing wrong? Am I speeding? Am I going too fast? Am I going too slow? Because I don't want to end up, in a situation where I have a cop that has not had training or good training, and they have not developed a rapport with the community. I don't want to say on edge, but they're going to be more apt to use their weapon at the first instance instead of all these other procedures we're talking about, de-escalation procedures.
Yeah, you're correct.
Let me do this real quick. We've had a caller. I'm sorry, go ahead, Judge.
No. Go ahead, take the call.
Yeah, let me grab this caller real quick, and then we'll come right back to you, Judge. 323 area code, 9666.
What's going on, Stan? This is Rob from out in Cali.
How you doing?
I'm good. I just wanted to give my two cents on what's been going on. I've been listening to what's been talked about. I'm going to just go ahead and give you the disclaimer, and it's not for anybody on the panel, but this isn't really going to be more of a pro-police statement, what I got to say, because I'm going to tell the truth from the angle of a concerned citizen. Okay, so I'm a 30-year-old male. I engage the community. I obviously live out here in L.A., and I engage the community daily, and I'm going to say this. I'm not really of the perspective that I need to live in fear because of how police are treating people of color. And I've also left out, I'm a black male too, for those that don't know, dark-skinned black male. And I hate that it hasn't really been talked about enough, but as I give the prelude, I'm saying that if something should ever happen to me, I'm only wanting to put it out there that I'm not interested in the police need more training. I'm not interested in, cops have a hard job. I'm not interested in the, we need to get all the information so that we don't make an uninformed decision. The reality is we watched a police officer, a 26-year vet, kill a young man, a father at that, at point blank range, and yell taser, taser, taser prior to it. We also discovered a video out of Chicago of how the PD, they killed a 13-year-old young man that put his hands up, and they claimed he had a weapon. They saw him get rid of the weapon before he was shot. But again, what I'm trying to say is that if something should happen to me, and I believe that my story of being a young black male moving around this country freely as we are intended to is the story of a lot of young black men that are walking around today. And I personally believe if something should happen to me, that we need to work hard and diligent on pushing forward the narrative of ending qualified immunity, forcing the hand of police chiefs that are, or the good, quote-unquote, good cops that are out there, and we need to force that. I believe that if we haven't been doing it, if communities haven't been already doing it, we need to do a much better job of pressing these local politicians to say that we need to quit giving rights to police officers so they can kill people, because that's bullshit. I don't really want to hear how, well, wait a minute, what about this police officer? They have a family. I don't care. They took away a young father whose son is going to grow up and see that they're going to hate police now because he saw his father get shot at point blank range by a police officer over an air freshener and then maybe a marijuana warrant. So like this is what I'm talking about. I don't trust the police in especially from the angle that they keep making money while we keep dying. So I'm for whatever efforts. I know Maryland has already moved forward with removing the police Bill of Rights. I believe that similar legislation and more efforts to defund the police need to happen immediately. And I'm not saying it as a fear, as a citizen in fear. I'm saying it as a citizen in concern, because I'm a U.S. Navy veteran. I'm not going to die on my knees. I promise you, I'm not letting them push. I'm not letting anything happen to me without me going down without a fight. But I also want people to understand that they need to wake up, because it's no longer if it happens, it's when. That's all I have to say, Stan. I mean, other than that, defund the police, period. Thank you.
All right. Come on, Judge.
I agree with him 1,000%, and I agree with you, Attorney Clark. I have three black young men that I raised, and I totally understand. I get it. So when they leave, and they're all grown, my oldest one is getting ready to be 39 in 3 days. No, in 7 days, going to be 39. And I still pray every day that when they leave out of the house, that they're going to come back. That they're going to come back. I have four black brothers. So I totally, totally understand. And it's sad that we as black women have to be so fearful that when our loved ones leave, that they may not come back. And over a basic traffic stop, it's crazy. If I'm hurt, it's crazy. It should never, ever happen. It should never, ever happen. When you leave, I should be expecting you to come back the same way that you left out the door. You want to come back in my door. And it's sad that it's not that way. We shouldn't have experienced it at all. And I have to, you know, when you talk about police going through, you know, get themselves ready before they become police officers and go out through training. Do the officers ever have to take a mental evaluation? Does that ever happen? Because just because you want to be a police officer doesn't mean that you ought to be a police officer. Do you ever have to go through mental evaluation? Because a lot of them, from the reaction that you see in the community, there's something up here that is not right.
You know, Judge, I can only speak for Texas. I know Joe will talk about Illinois, but you require here in Texas an initial psychological evaluation in order to get hired, which is required by the regulatory agency. But the problem is that's the only one that's required. Mm-hmm. There's not a continuation. Many of my council members are listening. They're going to spend some money, but for my agency, what I found in talking to some of my peers here in our state is a resiliency program. But not only is it the physical health, right? Because a heart attack on duty is going to be multi-$1 million to the community, but mental, with annual mental screenings, required mandatory mental screenings every year. Because you will find in this profession that attitudes change.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I instituted in my department, and again, we are not a big place, but even if you're a certified officer here in Texas and you have left your agency in good standing and you want to come to work for me, you have to go take another psychological exam. There's a way that we don't, as officers, don't have to. If you have less than 180 day break in service, you can just come right on in, right, without another mental evaluation. But I truly believe that psychologically this job changes you. And I don't care if you mm-hmm. if Joe Mosley came to my agency, he would have to take a psychological. He would be required to take a psychological exam. Same thing with Stan. Stan decided he wanted to get back in the business. But he's going to be required to do it because things change. And he isn't shaking his head up there. And I know he's got tons of information on that. So I think that I'm on the right track, whether people want to accept that or not. But we're going to have to, as an administrator, I've got to make sure that my people are at the peak, the best that they can possibly be. They're going to be out policing the community. And that's what they hired me to do. So that's what I'm going to do. I got to be innovative. And again, I didn't come up with this idea. I'm going to steal this idea from a chief that I know that I really respect. And that's what I do. I'm going to put it into my community, and that way I can get the best service. And I say service because we're serving the community. I want our officers to be able to do that. I know we're going to run across bad people, but in for the 99% of the time that we're out there, I want the best attitudes and the best. For my folks, not only the people that work for me, but the people that live in my community.
We're at the 18-minute mark. Before I go to this next caller and then to Billy and the judge to get their final thoughts before we go in, Judge, when I do the YouTube later, I'm going to take out the excerpt of what you just said, because I think what you just introduced was something that between the two sides in this argument that can't seem to find a middle ground. What I found amazing is when you talked about the reference to your black sons and your fear when they leave out of the house, and Billy talking about his fear when he leaves out the house. It is exactly what the wives of police officers are praying for their husbands when their husbands or wives go out to work. And so what you just, that's the building block. That's the ground. Both of us can agree on either side that we are concerned with our levels. So let's stop for a minute. If we're willing to give this blanket understanding and trust to the police side, then we ask for those who support the police, which is nothing wrong with that, to also understand how this segment feels. So what you just did was amazing. And it really introduced a bridge, I think, into it. But let's go to this caller real quick, 314 area code, 4600. Good morning.
Stan, thank you for that you just put out. Nobody looks at the police side. And I got two questions to ask real quick. You were a police officer. Now, if you pull a car over and you run their tags and it comes back on your computer that this person has a felony warrant out against them, how do you approach that driver after you call for backup? With your taser out or your gun out? Another point, I'm going to ask the chief. In Chicago, as of last Wednesday, less than a year, 335 days since I started keeping track based on Chicago Sun-Times and Chicago Tribune, there has been 4,272 blacks shot by other blacks with 664 murders. Now, would that department in Chicago get around to apprehending all those 4,272 criminals that shot someone? Your answer, please. Thank you.
Mine will be real quick, Chief, to him. It's simply this. I've had that at midnight. First thing good officers do, I was trained to do, slow everything down. I got the car pulled over, slow it down. There's no need for Stan to run up to the car. And so what Stan's going to do is wait till Stan has not one, but a second backup officer. That is three of us now going up there to deal with it from a liability standpoint and an officer safety standpoint and a citizen safety standpoint. So I don't need to run up to the car and deal with that felon. But go ahead, Chief.
We ain't going up there. They're coming back to us. Mm-hmm. IRS stop. And so we got to sit there for 25, 30 minutes, 5 hours.
Okay.
We're gonna sit there and wait until they come out. I guess this question would be, are they going to solve all those murders and apprehend those people? No. I mean, we've talked about it, and I thought he was going to go on a black-on-black crime thing. And I think, you know, Joe has dealt with that, you know, time and time again. Is it an issue for Chicago? Yeah, probably. Do they have the tools and resources to take everybody into custody as a result of those? No. I mean, murders are tough. Joe's perfect example. Murders are tough to investigate. Not all the pieces magically fit like they do on CSI. It doesn't work that way. So, no. That's simply not gonna happen.
Well, let me just...
Real quick, Joe, because we're at the 14 mark.
Well, let me just say this to that caller. First of all, the question is bullshit. Let me tell you why it's bullshit. All felony stops are just not the same. There are felony gun stops. There's felony warrant stops. There's all different ones. So each one is going to stop a different way. We know that. But to make that, see, that's pouring gasoline on the fire. And that's what that call is about. So, no, you're not going to make the same approach to all felony stops. So let's be clear on that.
All right, let's drop down while we got a little bit of time left. We got Big Billy. Billy, I mean, you spent so much. Number one, you always, when I said you, can you be here? You're always here, brother. And I appreciate it. You mean a lot to this show. You're an important part to this show. And I get a lot of comments from people. They like you taking the time. There's not enough attorneys that are taking the time to be in these type of forums regularly and provide good information. You know, some of them are ambulance chasing, some of them are grandstanding on people, but not you. You know, you're in Dallas, but you're from Waco, and you always give and follow Waco. So personally, we all appreciate you being here, brother. Take a minute, recap the campaign, and tell us anything you want us to know.
Thanks, Dan. I just want to say I am running for Dallas County Judge for, it'll be in March, April of 2022. It's a big position, but I think my leadership, you know, having served in uniform for 22 years as an aviator and as an attorney here in Dallas County, I think I got a lot of leadership and a lot of things that are, you know, in my background that could help me to help our entire county. And hopefully, you know, when I'm elected, it's not just going to stay within our county. I can help other counties and be that voice of reason and try to do something different so that we can all work together and live together. One of the biggest things is police accountability and safety. And like I said, I have a ton of friends on this show and here in Dallas that are officers. And I do want them to be safe. I enjoy what they do. I applied for a police position in Clinton County before. I understand what they do. It's critical. And we need our cops. We need our police departments. But we do need to change the focus a little bit and put the citizens first, because that's who we're serving. And the only way we can put the citizens first is to understand what they're telling you. Why, as a black male, am I so sincere of a police pulling me over versus, you know, if somebody, a gangbanger, something pulls me over, I'm not as terrified of that. But somebody that's, you know, designed to protect and serve me, I know that any situation can make you go that way. And that's what we got to look at, why that is happening. Why, when a black officer pulls over someone, you're more likely to survive that situation versus when a white officer pulls over, you know, the same person. So.
All right, appreciate it, Judge. Homegirl.
Hey.
Take some time and tell us about your campaign. Once again, it's so good to see you. It's been so many years.
I know. Thank you. It's good to see you.
We were little kids.
That's DC.
Yeah, no joke.
Well, first I want to ask Judge Clark. I'm going to go ahead and call you Judge Clark. What type of judge are you running for? Are you running for a big court? Are you running for an MPJ? What are you running for?
Well, I'm actually not running for a judicial judge. I'm running for the county judge, which is the Dallas County judge.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Well, I wish that is definitely a service, you know? And so I want to again thank you so much, Stan, for having me on the show. I am Judge Sonia Knight, and I am already in the seat at District Court 12204, and I am asking that everyone keep me at my seat, so I'm asking that you get out and vote on May 18, 2021. I am running on my record. I am running on a record well done, as I must say for myself, because I am the judge that cares about the community. I'm the judge that loves the community. I am the judge that is willing to give you a second chance if the second chance is needed, and sometimes a third chance, because at the end of the day, my job is to serve and serve with passion, with love, and with concern. And so when I sit on a bench, I do the same thing when I'm off the bench. I am impartial. I'm fair. I'm unbiased. And I am true. I am consistent to what I am supposed to do. I took an oath to do my job and to do it well. And I thank my community for putting me in office to serve that way. I now have 7 people running for my seat. I must tell you that I am the only judge that is qualified, that cares, and that is doing the job and doing the job well. I took the job, well, I always call it a service. To me, it's called a service, you know, even though it's a job. I'm making $90,000 a year. I did not know that I was going to be making $90,000 a year until a previous judge, Michael Stork, told me what I was going to be making a year. You could pay me $30,000 a year. My job was to get in the position and make a change in my community because I love my community. I'm the same way on the bench as I'm off the bench. Always wanting to give a helping hand where a helping hand is needed. I work well with several of the different organizations in our area trying to do our best to bring the next person up wherever there's needed. I'm just going to throw a couple of the different organizations out there, if that's okay. I work well with is a young man named Michael in our community. It's called Capital Rebirth. There's another organization in our community that I work with, which is Road to Go, the YMCA, the YWCA, Loop BMG, and Breaking Chains. We are in the community working together, partnering, and helping our community to be a better community, mentoring the young people, mentoring some older people, you know, women and the males. I just believe in doing the right thing by all people, not just our blacks and our browns, but white people. We're all in it together. We bleed the same blood, which is red. We just have to be all different shades of people. But at the end of the day, our job is to come together, be together, and unite for the betterment of our community. So I thank you so much, Dan, for having me on the show. I had such a wonderful time. This record was 204 Judgment Night. Just thanking you so much. Thanking you so much. Vote for me, District Judge Sonia Evans Knight, District Court 12204, where I am the MDJ that cares about you and yours. Thank you.
Billy, real quick, can you tell them again about your event that you're posting, where people can find that event? Is it going to be online where they can listen in?
Yeah, it's going to be on May 13th. Part of it's going to be in person. We're having it at Paul Quinn College, located in Dallas County. Right now we have about 8 or 9 officers, police chiefs, that are going to be taking part in it. Like, I just got an email recently that DeSoto Police Chief Costa is going to be on there as well. So now we get more and more people, I guess, from this show, fan that are signing up to participate. So it's going to be partially on Zoom, and we're going to have limited in-person because of the COVID social distance parameters. But you'll see it posted on my website. If you go to clarkfordallascounty.com, that's clarkfordallascounty.com, you can find out more information about my campaign. You can find out how to donate to the campaign, because the only way to win is we got to get our word out, get our name out, so people know who we are, and it takes money. I don't want to spend my own money. I can, but it's not going to be coming from the community. I want the community's involvement, so we can have know more about my campaign than where we want. So look for me, clarkfordallascounty.com. You can volunteer, you can donate, you can find out more about the campaign.
All right, brother, appreciate it. All right, Chief. We're at the 5-minute mark, and I'm going to turn it down so we don't hear that lady counting out. But sum it up, Chief.
Well, one of the points I wanted to make was, especially with the judge had to say, and Billy had to say, about the perspective on their children, going out. To me, that's vitally important information that needs to be shared. you hit the head on the head, you know, because my wife and your wife was doing the same thing, Joe's wife, you know, looking over us for our protection when we go out. And that needs to be communicated to officers, that there are people out there that simply fear the officers, and they need to understand that when they come in contact with them. And I think if we have that understanding, then it would be easier to de-escalate and say, look, there's nothing for you to worry about, you know, et cetera, on and on. So I think that's an important part of the training and part of the human aspect of this job. I'm going to go back and say I'm only one guy. But, you know, we're trying our best to make this work. And again, it goes back to things like this, you know, the people that come on the show and have the ideas. I think that the major media should tune in some point in time, probably listen to people that are actually doing it versus just what they believe should be done, backed up by information from our relative journalists. That's all I got to say.
All right. Appreciate you, Chief.
For the weekly cutoff in the middle of what I'm going to say, but
it ain't me.
Just happened.
No, you're good. We can hear you.
All right. So far. All right. So, I mean, we didn't get to talk about it, but I think when we bring up the Chicago incident, especially, people need to start looking past the low-hanging fruit of police officers. Need to focus on your city officials and your city managers, your mayors. And again, we have another incident in Chicago where people sat on this information, denied, made up information, said it was one thing, it turned out to be another. And you need to start asking yourself, why are they sitting on it? Because if they wanted to establish that communication that we've been talking about, the judge has been talking about, they should have been on top of that from the get-go. They should have released the video. They should have said, no, you guys did this once before. We're not doing it again. And we're going to open a lot of communication and establish accountability. But they didn't. They sat on it again. And why did they sit on it? Another thing that we need to talk about is that gentleman who called in. From my side of the work, very frustrating. There's a large division right now in the population, whether you're pro-police, anti-police. And you're getting a lot of this from mainstream media. Mainstream media is run by private companies. And you need to start asking yourself about what the story is, the narrative that they're telling you. Because there is a division, but there are more people that are really trying to work on changing these things and reform these things. And these private media companies profit more off of perpetuating that narrative of division than they do off of perpetuating a narrative of reform. And I think people need to read more. You need to start looking more into these topics and not just letting the media to guide how you feel about these things. Because there is a problem. But the way it's being perpetuated in mainstream media is not a narrative of reform. It's not a narrative of constructive change. It's just a narrative of division, and it doesn't benefit anybody.
All right, brother. Appreciate it. Joe, final thoughts, and you take us out.
Like Mike said, Mike Denham, one of my friends, said, there's a whole legal system that protects corruption and corrupt police officers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got to come, you know, as they say, you know, chicken's coming home to roost, and we've got to do something about it. With that, thank you, Judge. Thank you, Billy. Of course, Big Chief. My man, the Puerto Rican player from New York. And I'm good with that.
All right. Appreciate you guys. Love you guys. Everybody be safe. Thanks to everybody on Facebook. Wake up. Harrisburg. Come on, Billy. Throw it out.
Let's do it.
All right.
We're doing shots. 33rd state of city in Texas.
Yeah. Congratulations, Chief. Congratulations. And I'm just sad. I'm just raising hell, and I'm so pleased for people to send hate mail too. If I can forward it to Joe. We're all out. Everybody be good and have a good day. Be safe.
Thank you, everybody. You can follow Skin Mason and Behind the Blue Curtain at skinmason.com. On Twitter, at Officer Skin Mason. On YouTube and on Facebook, at Skin Mason. Be safe.